This is the podcast Byzantium and Friends. I am Anthony, your host. Welcome to episode 112. Before we get to today's topic, I want to announce that I've recorded a series of podcast discussions with Robin Pearson of the History of Byzantium podcast, where we talk about some of the ideas that emerged from my recent just published History of Byzantium, the New Roman Empire. Because I didn't want to make this podcast about that, I know you don't come here to hear me, but the guests. So to keep this focus on the guests, we did a series of discussions with Robin about emperors, about the overall history of the Eastern Empire and some of its underlying dynamics. And you can go find those discussions on his site or wherever you get podcasts from, the History of Byzantium. I think there was a total of seven of them from episode 265 intermittently down to episode 283. So one of the topics that we discussed there were the underlying structural features of the Eastern Empire that enabled it to survive for so long. In fact, I had noticed, and had long noticed, a kind of recurring pattern in its overall history, which is that at some point it will be hit by a largely exogenous shock, be it a plague or an invasion. Now think, for example, of the Arab invasions of the 7th century or the Seljuk invasions of the 11th, or even the Fourth Crusade, which will cause a massive disruption in a very small amount of time. And that in the aftermath of that disruption, there would be a much longer period of recovery and revival, which would, we now know, entail considerable amount of economic and demographic growth, gradual but unmistakable, including in the archaeological record. So we have this kind of rhythm of shock followed by gradual reinvestment and expansion, especially of the agricultural economy, but also of military capability and security. In fact, most of the history of this state consists of those periods of recovery, whether after the 3rd century crises, the 7th century crisis, and 11th century, and so forth. There are centuries of growth in between, which indicates to me at least that the sources of resilience are primarily endogenous, the sources of shock, what contribute to the, you know, quote, decline and fall model are primarily exogenous. It is, of course, impossible to separate these two entirely, but some interesting conclusions are drawn when you start to, you know, apportion the causality in those different baskets and see exactly what the factors were that enabled this society to recover from those kinds of shocks, or to not feel certain shocks or experience certain kinds of problems that other comparable sort of peer states and empires did at the time or later. Well, our topic today is a strikingly parallel history, though it takes place on a smaller time scale, which is specifically the history of the city of Rome in Italy between the 4th to the 7th century, but primarily 5th to 7th, which follows a similar pattern. In fact, you can almost call it a kind of smaller fractal version of the bigger picture with those bigger movements that we see in the history of the Eastern Empire. So the city of Rome itself, starting famously in the early 5th century, experiences a number of these shocks, being sacked by the Goths and the Vandals, and also experiencing bouts of civil war in the West and the loss of the Western Emperor and its rule by these, quote, barbarian kings. And then Justinian's invasion and the Lombard invasion and so on. And these events obviously form the basis for the narrative of the decline and fall of the Western Empire. So what happens to Rome is taken sometimes as being a kind of symbol or microcosm of what was happening in the Western Empire as a whole. But it appears that what was going on was a dynamic that was strikingly similar to what I've observed the big picture of East Roman history. And this phenomenon was studied very recently in a book by my guest, Michelle Salzman. The book is called The Falls of Rome, Crises, Resilience, and Resurgence in Late Antiquity, and it explores how primarily the Western senatorial aristocracy would return to the city of Rome. I mean, return not necessarily in a physical way, but return in terms of investing and reinvesting in the institutions and buildings and economy of the city, and try to get it going again after each one of these shocks. And so the book, which is brilliantly researched and very, very clearly narrated, talks about these individual shocks and then focusing especially on the period of recovery that followed each one. Now, there is way more going on in the book than we could discuss in a podcast length, so I definitely encourage you to read the book for more. In particular, one aspect that we didn't get to, largely for reasons of time, is the role, or actually relative absence, of the bishops of Rome, the popes, from this whole story. So there is this traditional narrative that as the emperors leave from Rome, as the Western aristocracy kind of degrades, as the Western Empire falls, that the bishops of Rome step in and fill that gap of leadership and power in the city of Rome and kind of take over a lot of the functions that had been left on the table by these departing institutions. But Michelle actually finds that that doesn't seem to be the case, that it is not until much, much later that popes are left largely by default as the sort of principal leaders of the city, and that until that time, the senatorial aristocracy are the key stakeholders in this process, and that they continue to basically run the city. In fact, I mean, if there's a villain in the piece, and there kind of isn't, but if it is, it's Justinian and the way he reorganized the administration of Italy after the war with the Goths to basically give more control to Eastern administrators and military types, which made what the Western Senate had been doing largely irrelevant, kind of marginalized them, and the whole institution just kind of disintegrated. Anyway, I say this so that you know that there is a parallel story running alongside that of the Senate in the book, which is that of the bishops of Rome and when they did and didn't participate in this process, and you know what were their means by which they did so. So that you will find in the book. We just don't have the time to talk about it here. But the story of the Senate was by itself really fascinating and eye-opening for me to see how the same similar kinds of dynamics played out in the West, even in the absence of a emperor figure sometimes. Or also in the context of, you know, constantly losing provinces outside of Italy. Michelle is a professor of history at the University of California, Riverside, and she's written many other important studies. I was very happy that she agreed to come on and talk with this one with us. Also, thanks to medievalist.net for reposting these episodes. So let's get right to my discussion with Michelle Salzman. Hello, Michelle. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So I was really happy to read your book. I have shelves and shelves of unread books. And occasionally I'll just wander in there and pick something off, you know, the next thing. And I happened to be thinking about resilience and thought, it's about time I read this because I've had it on the shelf for a year or so. So I was really happy that you were working on this, that you worked on this topic in late antiquity. And especially that you focused on the city of Rome, because, you know, the whole topic of the fall of Rome is so big, and we now know that whatever happened happened differently in every region. And some places it was sort of apocalyptic, like in Britain. I've talked to Robin Fleming about what happened there. And some places, yeah, they might not have really noticed that much was happening on a year-to-year basis. And so I was really happy to see this study of what happened in the city of Rome. So can you start by giving us an overview of the kinds of crises that the city of Rome experienced between, you know, 410 and 600? I mean, just a typology of the sorts of things that happened so that we can talk about what resilience means.
Yeah. It was really, in some ways, frustration with the lack of attention on the city of Rome and the assumption that our Rome fell in 410 because of the attack by Alaric and the Goths, and that was it, and that's the end of the empire. And more recent archaeological work, as well as a host of texts and writers, show that life returned very quickly. And so the crises, so the ones I picked, the crises that are the ones that Romans at the time perceived as great moments of challenge, political and military moments. And I chose political and military attacks on the actual city of Rome, in which there was fighting, and in which the population at large would have been either displaced or killed or forced to leave to deal with the violence. But I wasn't interested in the violence per se, but rather the response to that violence and how Romans, I've been struck by how Romans returned after each of these, and I highlight four separate political and military crises that both ancient Romans and even modern historians focus on as the end of the city, the end of urban life. And they do have to deal primarily with barbarian incursions, either in the year 410, when Alaric and the Goths sieged and took the city for the first time in 800 years, or again, 45 years later in 455, when the Vandals captured the city of Rome totally unexpectedly. And then two other moments of real political and military conflict. The civil war that led to the fall of Rome between 470 and 472. And then, of course, the really long extended Gothic Wars that the Emperor Justinian's invasion of Italy incurred, leading to multiple sacks and seizures of the city. So it was those are the moments, the crises that I want to see responses to, right?
Yeah, and I really liked how you situated those moments of crisis within the sort of broader framework of sort of cascading problems that they caused in population and food supply and political authority, even in the physical infrastructure. And that resilience and what you call in the subtitle of the book, Resurgent, is an effort by primarily the Western senatorial class to rebuild after those moments. And the thread of your argument kind of follows the senatorial class. And I want to ask you what your benchmark for resilience is in the book. In other words, what sorts of activities and developments were you looking for to assess whether that class was successfully rebounding after the crisis?
It is true that I focus on leadership, and the leadership of senatorial aristocrats after each of these crises was really what struck me and moved me, because these are wealthy landowners who also are involved in government, political government. They have to have had some sort of civic office by this point to enter into the Senate and to become active politically. And their decisions to return again and again to the city to rebuild, and rebuilding on a physical level was certainly part of what I was measuring, you know, rebuilding, restoring, repairing not just buildings, but also statuary and monuments and houses. These are the kinds of sort of physical measures that we use even in the modern world. You know, after a military action, how do you measure recovery? Well, economic to some degree. Well, hard to trace economic, the movement of cash, but So, but you can see the investment in repairing buildings and structures. But I was also interested in the repairing of the institutions, the political and social institutions. So the return of community celebrations that you see with the revival of the circus games or the revival of animal hunts in the Colosseum, the repairs to the seats in the Colosseum are survived because of the inscriptions that various of these senatorial aristocratic families would have as they donated to repair what was the civic monument, the Colosseum or the Circus Maximus or the baths in the city of Rome. So those are the kinds of measures of both in some ways physical but also a social life and political life. The return of aristocrats to the Senate to act again, to take office, to take a leading role in trying to determine, trying to resolve the kinds of issues, raising money for food supplies, or raising money for the return of refugees, or responding to letters from emperors or would-be emperors. So these are the ways of measuring the return of the senatorial aristocracy, who were the I did add a temporal frame. I was looking at what happened in the immediate aftermath of crises, because as modern social scientists tell us, it's not just what you do, but when you do it. So if you are the fastest to show up to rebuild, you often have an outsized impact on the recovery and the return of population, which is also a significant measure. Who is taking on roles of leadership? Who will become, in Rome as in Constantinople, the local government was run by and large by a senator aristocrat who had the office of urban prefect. So urban prefect, sort of like the mayor of a city, was a really significant role. Where he devoted his funds, who took on that role? Was it a man with important senatorial connections from a traditional established family, or was it someone totally new who had to be sent in? So these were the kinds of people, and seeing what happened to the leaders prior to the crisis and after the crisis was another way of measuring recovery. And we see them returning to Rome, rebuilding their houses, rebuilding their fora, making political connections and marriages. These are the other ways of measuring on a social level the recovery of Rome.
Yeah, and I think it's important to say that that was not a given. In other words, you can easily imagine scenarios whereby the crisis itself undermined or eroded the very ability of the senatorial class to do these things, or even their very existence, or scenarios where they just decided to cut their losses and go off to their rural estates and build fortified villas and just kind of stay there to ride out whatever storm, or go into the clergy and become like you can imagine all kinds of scenarios, but you keep finding this pattern of return and reinvestment. So they're putting all of their surplus wealth back into the city, which indicates a commitment to its, survival and endurance. Just so that the audience might be more Eastern attuned, I was wondering if you could sort of briefly sketch the major differences between the Western senatorial class and the Eastern one in Constantinople at this time. Like, there's some important differences in the environment in which they're operating, and you draw some of these out in the book. Could you just mention some of those
Oh,
quickly?
yeah, sure. Yeah, actually, it's very striking how different the Eastern Senate and the Western Senate are. And it is true that both cities had senates, but the Eastern Senate really began and was originated by the family of Constantine. I have been Constantine, and especially his son Constantius II. And they too were, like in the West, wealthy landowners who had to have some sort of office. civic office in order to rise to the higher ranks. But by the 5th century, when the emperors in the East are constantly there, the Eastern Senate really is very much aligned with the emperor. And very, some have even said it's no more than the Privy Council, that is the advisory board, as it were, of the emperor. And you do not, although they're wealthy and important and powerful, they do not really take independent stands in opposition to an existing emperor that you can find. Whereas in the West, because the emperor is no longer really resident after Valentinian III, who comes back to reside in Rome in the middle decades of the 5th century, after that period, the emperors who do return to the city are not particularly powerful. And after 476, there is not a resident Western emperor. There's a king, a barbarian king. And so the Senate really becomes politically much more active in the West and independent and autonomous. And I actually see it as an outgrowth of their negotiations in the early part of the century with Alaric and the Goths, that they revived a very independent political action. Plus, they had a long, long history, a tradition of independence and autonomy going back to, oh, to Romulus's times, to the Republic. And so they had traditions of autonomy that they had maintained and were proud of that allowed them to assert their authority over and against the wishes of emperors who, after all, were far away. And I think it's really one really good instance of that comes to my mind, which is in the early part of the 6th century, in something called the Acacian Schism, in an argument about theology, when the Eastern Emperor in 516, Anastasius, wanted the Pope to agree to his formulation. He sent a letter to the Senate of Rome asking the Senate to intervene with the Pope. And we actually have that letter, which is wonderful. Now, you wouldn't have that kind of reliance, that kind of attempts to get the Senate to act in the East in any way. And what's even more remarkable is that the Senate in the West said, no, thank you. We're not going to, we agree with the Pope in this case, and we're not going to follow your wishes. So that's a real, to me, a very good example of the autonomy and the independence that the Western Senate had, especially after there no longer was a Western emperor. But even so, I think those are the key differences. And we have the senators, the urban prefect in Rome. I've done a lot of work working on one late 4th century prefect of Rome, the Symmachus, the Roman orator. And he will oppose, he will argue against the policies of the emperors. You don't see that in the East. You just don't, it doesn't happen. It's not attested.
Yeah, I hadn't appreciated it so clearly until I saw it in your book that, I mean, this is, of course, a very venerable order. It's one of the longest lived political institutions in history with a continuous, right, tradition and sense of its own identity and history. And I hadn't quite realized how they kind of came into their own in the end, once the emperors had kind of left Rome and they were reviving these old traditions of, their own kind of political autonomy and say. I found it, this is kind of this is sort of charming in a way, given the circumstances in which they're operating. There's one thing that I'd like to point out, and this isn't terrible. I mean, it comes up in your book a couple of times. It's not sort of very central, but there's an old idea. I guess it's even in Jones's big history and so on, that Western senators were immensely wealthy, much wealthier than their Eastern counterparts. And all of this is based on one fragment of Olympiodorus.
Right.
Yes. So this is a Greek historian, early 5th century, and he has this passage that survives that he talks about the revenues of some Western senatorial families, and the sums are enormous.
Yeah.
And when I was writing my history and was and had actually I had collected all kinds of expenditures and revenues just to have a sense of this a scale for the worth of money, the sums that he reports are impossible. They're just flat out impossible. There is absolutely no way that they were making that kind of revenue, at least in my mind. And I was happy to see that Hartmut Lepin published an article a few years ago where he also questions that number. Now, there's no problem in the manuscript tradition. In other words, it's not like it's been mis as far as we know, that it's been misreported, but it's just out of this world.
Right.
And I was glad to see that he was also like, this does not add up. And it's fundamental, like that one number that he reports, a couple numbers, or just anyway, I just wanted to say that because it, if you take that out, it removes this kind of like, the Western Senate is like, they're plutocrats and immensely wealthy and all of that compared to the East. The East at this time has much more opportunities for growth and profit. But anyway, okay, I'm digressing on a, so let's get back to the Western Senate here. And I was just wondering if, so I got the sense from your book that you, I don't know, not admired them, but like appreciated what they were doing. Like you kind of sympathized with their efforts to get things back together again. And I was just wondering if you had any reservations about that, given that these are, you know, these are like super elite, wealthiest people who, you know, they're always, in the way of these types, they're always like presenting themselves as a solution to problems that they might have themselves imagined
Created.
and causing. So I was just kind of wondering if you grappled with that, like the even the contemporary political dimensions of that, given how we're surrounded by these super wealthy plutocrats who think they can save the world.
Well, that's, it is true that I am. Two confessions. I finished this book during COVID, so the idea of resilience. And was very personal in a certain sense. You know, how do you recover in the face of, you know, what is and the totally unexpected, you know, plague of our generation, as it were. But I did have I guess I do admire the ability to return to rebuild in the face of what would have been devastation, because as you said, there were many opportunities. Most of these wealthy elites, and I agree with you, the numbers in Olympia de Rosa are just over the top. But they, if you take them more metaphorically, these Westerners had multiple estates across the West and the East very often. So we can see some families, like the family of the Simmachy, going to. Or Nicolaus Delibes going to Constantinople after there's the capture of Rome in 455, and then so they do have various options, but the desire to come back was what impressed me. And yeah, admittedly, people would often ask, well, why are you focusing on the elites? What about non-elites? Don't they suffer as well too? But in a sort of hegemonic society as ancient Rome was, elites' efforts sort of trickle down. Do they sometimes act in selfish ways? Absolutely. Right. So Nicolaus Olybrius, the senator who fled after the Vandal sack, was sent back by the Eastern Emperor to try to mediate this conflict between the then Emperor Anthemius, who had been sent by the East. And Ricimer, who was the very powerful barbarian general. But rather than mediating, Nicias Olybrius decided he would run for the office of emperor and help to sort of fuel a civil war. So yes, they don't know, he, rather than solving the problem and trying to mediate this, he fueled what would be the civil war that would that led to the fighting of 470 and then the ultimate demise. So I do think that leadership with a conscience matters, and so that's part of the my interest in, and that leadership matters. So that's the other factor. Those leaders who can win the support of other Romans, both elites and non-elites, can have a very positive impact. And so that was part of what drew me to this class. So, and I guess the other thing is that people see them following the passage you were talking about as super rich elites who don't really care about politics, don't care about religion, are just involved in sort of self-serving acquisition of honor and pleasure, or on the other side, go directly into the church and are so totally ascetic, and it's both. And that's neither of those types, are the ones that we see active in these historical moments. In fact, one of the other interesting things that I find is that rather than retreat by going into the church, these families, these traditions of service bring these families of the Dikii, the Simiki, all of these names, they bring them back to serve in political offices and civic political offices time and again. So not that they were perfect by any means, they made mistakes.
There are occasions in the book where you do point out, behavior that is equivalent to the current saying, never let a good crisis go to waste, where they are taking advantage of the opportunities that crises create. But I can see the COVID connection because you're also interested in the repair and functioning of institutions.
Yes.
And I remember during COVID where all of a sudden institutions that I thought, were sort of well-regulated and lubricated machines that would, implement public policy were kind of creaking and having real difficulty in performing basic tasks. And these senators, they are very invested and invest in the functioning of institutions that benefit others as well. And in particular, you're constantly talking about the grain supply, the food supply for the city of Rome, which is something that doesn't benefit them personally. Like they're invested in making sure that the population of Rome can survive as well. And I think this is one of the big differences between those elites and modern, our own plutocrats, is that they did have a sense of public service. And they did put their money, where that sense was. Whereas ours, I think, are looking solely for how to profit and do nothing for anyone. I don't
Or
know. I just.
just to maintain themselves in office today, right? So that
Yeah.
which will allow them to profit, right? But it's very hard to capture. I mean, one of the critical moments in terms of the food supply, and I use that as a proxy because we actually have some numbers about how many people are being fed by the state. We can use those numbers to help us to see, to also measure recovery, right? The number of people who come back is based, the best population estimates are based on what we know about the food supply and the state supply of a certain percentage of the population with grain and pork and subsidized wine, things like that. The honor or the glory that's attached, or the criticism that's attached to these senators who are in charge of the food supply, is something I think hard to capture, right? But you're right, it's because they have a sense of public service and honor. If you can fulfill the needs of the people of Rome, supply them with food. I don't want to say bread and circuses in a negative way, but it's seen as a great that this is part of your responsibility, and you get rewarded positively or negatively for that. So one of the critical moments after the sack of Rome in 410, we hear about the urban prefect mayor writing to the emperor saying, "Hey, I don't have enough grain, and I need more because people are returning, and we don't have enough in the food supply." And it's a really important assertion of the needs over against what the emperor at the time wanted to give. And so there's that kind of attention to making the system work again, the institution of food supply work again, which is seen as the responsibility of senator aristocrats in a very immediate way, you know.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. It's unlike, in some sense, modern politicians who seem who are too often assert that they're helping the people, but actually they're mostly concerned about getting reelected. So yeah.
Yeah, the grain supply in the population of Constantinople is something that I was tracking throughout the book. It's just a general topic that I'm interested in, also for the East. And so, just to give the very big picture, we start with a Rome that has maybe 800,000 to 1 million people, and later on in your story, toward the end, it shrunk to maybe a tenth of that, 100,000 or possibly, well, depending. I mean, during actual sieges, it might have fallen further than
Well
that.
below that.
Yes. And to a certain degree, the size of that population is dependent on the ability of the senate or the state to ensure the grain supply. Now, without getting into the sort of technical details and conjectures that we use to assess that size of the pie, that can get us, yeah, we can go down a rabbit
Yeah,
hole.
it gets us into the weeds a lot.
What are some of the main factors that contributed to that decline in population? Put differently, why are people leaving and where are they going?
Yeah, I really tried to track that, but these disruptions, these crises, were certainly times when people fled. And although a certain percentage came back, not all did. You know, even senator aristocrats, those who had estates in the East, or those who had branches of their family in other places. During the Gothic War, we know several of them went to Constantinople. Certain percentage came back, but not everybody. And I think it's true across the board that these kinds of disruptions, civil, military sieges, sacks, occupations, led people to leave. And I think that was a decrease in the population. For one, you know, just like today, if you have a war, and a certain percentage of people will find and make lives in other places where they don't have to recover their losses. Some people die in the process. There's one of the most beautiful silver treasures on the Esquiline Hill. With a beautiful wedding casket of a woman named Prajekta, was buried on the Esquiline and was recovered in the 19th century. Her family never came back, just disappeared. So, you know, so I think that's true. Also, there's no doubt that the loss of large parts of the Western Empire, you know, over the course of this period, Rome. The West shrinks, loses control of increasingly sections of, well, if you said Britain and Spain and sections of Gaul and North Africa. So the Rome had always been and remained to the end a magnet for new men, new women who wanted to make their way into the political world or into the economic world. And so with the shrinkage of the empire, those reasons for people to come also declined. So
Yeah.
you might say immigration
Yeah.
declined as it became harder. A key moment has to be the loss of the grain supply from North Africa after the Vandals capture Rome in 455. They no longer have to send grain to Rome. Africa, North Africa being the breadbasket for the city. They no longer have to send grain. Rome has to buy its grain from North Africa now. And here's a case where the senators are making more money because Sicily and central Italy now becomes a breadbasket. And these senators are actually making quite a lot of money from that shift in the trade. But I acknowledge that Rome had lost this source of supply. Certainly traveled. People knew that things were not quite as easy to access in Rome, right? And as the state supply of the state's funding for food supplies also repressed the prices of food in the city of Rome. So after 455, that mechanism was less effective. So I think there are good reasons.
Yeah, and they can't get grain from Egypt thanks to Constantinople.
But that had been the case ever since Constantine. So
Constantine,
that's really
then.
not really, that's not really a factor. Africa, North
Yeah.
Africa had
Stepped up to
stepped
the plate.
in
Yeah.
earlier. And it's also Sicily, really. Sicily takes off and new roads are being built in Sicily ever since the 4th century. So that's not new, right, as much, I think.
So I wanted to ask you about one of your chapters. The other chapters are called like responses to the sack of 410, responses 455. And then there's a chapter called Why Gibbon Was Wrong. So what was Gibbon wrong about?
Oh, so many things. Oh, well, I think probably that Gibbon originally intended to write his history only about the city of Rome. And he had intended to end in 476 with the removal of Romulus Augustulus, right? I think in some ways, he was completely wrong to focus on the last Western emperor as if that was a tremendous transition and the end of Rome, right? And in some ways, he was wrong to completely turn away from Rome and look and he looked east and went forward, as into the 15th century. But it was really his focus on the loss of the Western Emperor as the measurement for a decline and fall that I was thinking about in that chapter. Because, as I said, the Civil War and the fighting that preceded that was really much more destructive of society and much more destructive of the infrastructure, the physical structure of the city, as well as the social patterns. And I also think he was, by that time, the senator aristocrats had more or less come to the agreement that a Western emperor was no longer needed. And so he's focusing on the removal of the Western emperor as a sign of fall seems to me misguided. Like the structures, the institutions continued, albeit under Odoacer, barbarian kings. So his notion that you needed to have an emperor to have an empire in the West seems to be misguided because the structures, the society, the language, the culture persisted well into the 6th century and after.
And under Theodoric, who kind of reenact the role of a Western emperor, even without the title officially. This continues for another half century of relative peace and prosperity in Italy, and he fulfills all those functions. And in a certain sense, Italy continues as a part of the Roman world. It's just with a odd, qu quote unquote, constitutional arrangement about who's controlling the armies in Italy. But I think most historians now are perfectly happy to continue the history of ancient Italy into the 6th century. At which point, a set of developments happen that brings this story to an end. And so you date the end of this, the senatorial class and its ability to respond to these crises in the mid to late 6th century. And I was just wondering if you could give us a kind of brief overview of the factors related to Justinian's the war against the Goths, and the aftermath that spelled the end of this order and what it could do in Italy. Because I think this is the end of the story, really.
Yeah, I do, and much later than what Gibbon thought, for
Yeah.
sure. And Gibbon, the other thing I should say about Gibbon is he has this biological metaphor that this is, that this is fated to happen. And the one thing you can see about the Romans is that they did not see themselves as falling or falling on decline. They had crises, they had challenges, but they were constantly in the process of rebuilding, as it were, or recovering. So that's one of the reasons why that there's a phrase, the Indian summer under the Ostrogoths is true. That sort of half a century of peace and prosperity is something that, 50 years is a pretty long time, or even longer than 50 years. But the reasons that I focus on that period and see that as really undermining this whole sort of society is the fact that Justinian's reconquest brought with it structural changes in what was possible for the recovery of the central aristocracy in particular. So after the war, there is a famous set of documents called the Pragmatic Sanction, which lists all the ways in which Italy and the West is supposed to be governed after the war with the Goths is finally over. A 20-year war with many ins and outs, which you know very well, which divided the aristocracy and and forced the expulsion of some of them or their flight of to Constantinople, to other places as well. But after the Justinian retakes Italy, the possibility for rebuilding Rome, the city, and Italy is great. In fact, we do hear about some senatorial aristocrats coming back, but the structure that Justinian puts into place doesn't make it possible for the kind of political and economic recovery that these senators would have liked. There is no space in this recovery really for independent aristocrats, and I think Justinian didn't want to have them have political power. There is much more attention and reliance on the Byzantine military, who were there for the war, and the desire to have Knossos, for instance, rebuild the Tiber River and rebuild the infrastructure of the walls, rather than encouraging or incorporating Western senatorial aristocrats. Is a sign of the lack of willingness to use them in his government, in the new government. And the other factor that has changed is the incorporation of the bishops of Rome and of Italy into what we would know what would have happened before as sort of civic responsibilities. So Justinian, who has done that elsewhere across the empire, he's not going to treat Italy or Rome as different in that way. And I think those are really two structural changes that show that the bishops are going to have a much greater say in what's going on politically and who's feeding the city and the infrastructure and all the sorts of duties that in the past would have fallen on senator aristocrats. And so the options for senator aristocrats, even when they come back, there's not a political option. I mean, they could go into the church, and it's really after at the end of the Gothic War, during the Gothic War, that we first see, in my opinion, aristocrats becoming bishops or the Pope of Rome. Doesn't happen till then, because until then, those who are ambitious and have civic minded will be serving the urban prefects or praetorian prefects or be involved in other sort of civic positions. It's only when that is no longer the case that we see senators, men like Gregory, who comes from a wealthy aristocratic family, going into the church. So that's a broad structural change. And the Senate is not given the kind of authority or the kinds of responsibilities that it had had in the past. And so that's really the sort of structural issues that we can see. They exist, they continue to have sort of ceremonial functions, which are important, but they don't have the sort of the duties. These have been displaced by both the Byzantine military and by bishops.
Yeah, when I finished the book, I sat back and I thought that in a certain sense, it's framed so beginning and end by two actions that sort of deprioritize Italy in a certain way. The beginning was when Italy is taxed, like under the Tetrarchy for the first time. Like it just becomes a, in a sense, a regular province that's taxed just like any other. And at the end, you have the Justinianic and post-Justinianic administration of Italy, which is armies and bishops, the same way as many other province, like provincial provinces, sorry, frontier provinces are being governed, even in the east. And Italy just becomes a frontier province of the Eastern Empire without Rome being anything particularly important. Justinian just doesn't give that impression that he was interested in fostering that kind of culture that had led the city through these centuries, the way you describe. And this is interesting, and I don't know that you mentioned this, but there's no reason you should. But what happens in Italy in the 6th century is seen by some, like Byzantinists, as a precursor to what happens in the East after the Arab conquests. In other words, that provincial administration is turned over to generals and bishops, and you just don't have that kind of, city council slash senate, except in Constantinople. And it's kind of an advanced look at the 7th, 8th, and 9th centuries in the East.
I don't mention it, but I think it's true that this was part of what he had done before, in other provinces, right? So, and this is a distinct change. I do mention that after Justinian, Justin II sort of reverses some of this or tries to reverse some of this. But it is true that he's unwilling to recognize that old Rome has any claim on special status, and calling it old Rome doesn't give you much. It's not a positive thing in his sense, but it is true that it is very much disempowering of a whole group of leadership positions. And you could see why some Western aristocrats stayed in Constantinople, where there were many more possibilities for them to have the kind of active, engaged influence that they would have had in the past, either in Rome or some would say they couldn't go on to Ravenna. But even there's too much competition from Byzantine military new men and women. So it becomes very hard to recover, well, impossible to recover, I think, after Justinian's stipulations.
Who can survive Justinian? It's like a reality show. Okay,
He's not the
so
hero in this story, no.
no, yes, he's not. No, there's some books where Justinian just doesn't come out as the hero. And yeah, this is one of them. But I think he should have gone to Italy. I think he should have personally gone to Italy and shaken hands. I really think that for the good of Italy, I think he should have done that. But he was just so keen on, working the institutions from a distance, wherever he was, implementing policy. Anyway, that's a Okay, so let's in conclusion, let's just zoom out a little bit, because in the introduction you frame your study in an interesting way, and you say that you're going to situate your analysis sort of among, or sort of at the intersection of these three schools. They're catastrophists, transformationists, and world historians, which represent sort of different ways of looking at this period. Can you outline where your story, well, differs from all of those schools, where it possibly overlaps with them? What do you mean by them?
And this is very schematic
Yes,
because
understood. Absolutely.
after all, the decline and fall of Rome is such an old topic,
Yeah.
but the decline and fall of the city has not been quite as has not been considered that way, because most people in the past have said, well, 410 destroyed the city and it never recovered, and that was the end. And as I say in the introduction, that's not the way we know the city functioned now and developed for another two centuries or more, and thrived, we would say, I would say, to some degree, up until the 7th century. What I call the catastrophists are those who function on those turning points, who very much see the cataclysmic event, the military and political crisis, as undermining the system and bringing within it the seeds of the end of the city, that the city never recovers its viability, its population, its ability to meet the needs of any of its people, and that it lost complete political. And you'll still see that today, that people say Rome is a backwater in late antiquity and nothing happened there and it was irrelevant, right? It's only what happened in Constantinople, and that's the kind of simple way of stating things.
Hear,
So
hear.
here. And one of the things that I should say is, it struck me since I'm trying to talk to you, is the connections, the ongoing importance of the West to the East goes through this period. The desire to send an Eastern emperor and to sort of get involved in what's going on in the West is very continues all throughout this period, but I won't go there. So that's the catastrophist model. And I agree that there are these moments where you have breaks in traditions, where things radically shift. The loss of North African grain supply after the Vandal capture is huge. It requires a whole new system and way of funding, feeding people. It's a massive change, but it wasn't catastrophic. It didn't bring the end of the city. So that's why I didn't agree with catastrophists or those who believe only in sort of a military solution, a military fall. So those are the catastrophists to some degree. On the other hand, I'm more aligned with the transformationalists, because I do see changes occurring in response to these turning points. A crisis in Greek is a moment of judgment. You decide to do something or not. And so there are changes that allowed for the survival and revival of the city. And so I'm more inclined to agree with them. But the problem that I find with the transformationalists is that they're very vague about what exactly is changing. And they tend to focus on religious change and social change and continuity of literature and education, which is true, but they omit the sort of the political, military, and institutional changes. And some of the breaks, there are ruptures, there are things that do not continue. And I wanted to include that in my narrative as well. And I think they have huge implications, that people do not simply change, but they process events and things break, things don't recover. And that's what I wanted to get at to some degree. And finally, I admire people who talk about the sort of global importance and talk about the Roman Empire in conjunction with what's going on in China, for instance. You can get at very interesting big picture changes across the ancient world. And I think that's interesting, but it doesn't give you enough granularity. You can't see what's going on at an individual level. And it also removes people from the narrative. And I really wanted to talk about choices that individuals make when they decide to return to their homes after being forced to flee, and the sort of individual actions that we can recover based on, on evidence that still survives. And finally, I also think it denies the particularity of Rome with its traditions of service to the state, and with its traditions of honor and a particular culture of competition that fueled the return, particularly of men, but also of women, to rebuild and restore. And that kind of global big picture doesn't allow for understanding more individualized choices, not the narrative I was interested in.
Yeah, I could see from your story as it was unfolding how it's a story of how, traditions strive to survive and replicate themselves in the face of crisis on a local scale, like in Rome. And so that's your story. And I like that you framed it exactly among these three different approaches, which are not what you're doing. Anyway, and also, Michelle, this is a wonderfully written book. I have to say this for the audience too. You do a great job of bringing clarity to issues that are both technical and very general. So I strongly recommend the book to anyone who wants to get a Roman view of the fall of Rome, right? Anyway, so
Oh,
thank you for
thank
coming
you.
on.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was really fun to talk to it with an Easterner.
Yes. No, always looking sideways, east and west, Constantinople, sort of in the middle. Anyway, okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Michelle. Take care.
Thank you, Anthony. Bye-bye.